Welcome to the Democracy Group, a network of podcasts about democracy, civic engagement, and civil discourse. In this feed, you will find a sampling of episodes from our podcast and the Democracy Group, as well as recordings from our events. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please visit democracygroup.org to find more like this. Now let's get to our featured episode.
Welcome. We are talking politics and religion without killing each other. I am your host, Corey Nathan, and it is an honor to be a part of the Democracy Group, a network of podcasts that examines what's broken in our democracy and how we can work together to fix it. Please remember to subscribe or follow whatever your app lets you do. And definitely, I've been talking about leaving those reviews. Writing a review really does make a difference, especially on Apple, if you have the Apple Podcast app. And I'll put a link in our show notes to make it easy for you to do just that. It all helps. Just get the word out so more people can participate in the conversation, like the one we're having today with Elliot Kirshner. Elliot Kirshner is an Emmy Award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker. After a career at CBS producing for the Evening News, Sunday Morning, and 60 Minutes, Elliot joined his longtime collaborator Dan Rather as the senior producer for Dan Rather Reports and was his co-founder and co-writer on the legendary journalist's Substack, Steady. Elliot now writes for his own Substack, Through the Fog, and continues to develop film, television, digital, and social media projects. He's pretty prolific, actually. And he also leads the Science Communication Lab, an innovative nonprofit dedicated to experimenting with making the knowledge and process of science accessible to the general public, students, and educators. Elliot, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. And it's a mouthful to try to get through all that, so I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you, are you tired, man? It seems like you're doing a lot.
I do a lot, but I think that I love what I do, so I think that it makes it, you know, doesn't feel like work. I mean, sometimes it does. Work is always work, but there, I'm just, you know, I feel very lucky that I get to earn a living by being curious and sort of exploring my curiosity. So, what more can you ask for?
That's great, man. Being curious and exploring things and figuring out how to pay the bills. That's that's a pretty cool gig. I was curious about your background.
Yeah.
You know, you studied history and lit. I'm not familiar with the college that you went to. I'm just kidding. Harvard grad, right?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Are you from the Northeast? Is that?
I am not. No, I grew up in, I was actually born in New Jersey.
Where in Jersey?
In Princeton, which I think is a world unto itself.
No. We grew up two towns away from each other. I grew up in Manalapan. Yeah.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Well, I moved when I was five, my dad's an academic. He's a scientist. He was at Princeton when I was born, and then he came out to UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, which is a medical school for, I really consider myself from San Francisco originally. I mean, I was here from kindergarten through 12th grade. So it's, that's really home, my formative years. And then I applied out east, not knowing what I was getting into. I applied to Harvard, Yale, Princeton. I didn't get into two out of the three. I got into Berkeley, which I was really considering. And it felt like an adventure to go across the country and go to Harvard. I didn't know what I was getting into. And I just sort of packed the bags and went.
Was history and literature already avocationally what you were interested in high school, or is that something that you sort of congealed around over the course of your time at Harvard?
Yeah, it's, I think, a bit of both. I mean, I think I was somebody growing up that was pretty good at a lot of things, but not great in any one thing. I mean, I thought there was always people in my classes who I thought were better at math or were better at music or better athletes. Better writers, but I felt like I was at a pretty good level at a lot of these. And so I entered college not really knowing what I was interested in, but I figured out pretty soon that I didn't want to become an academic. And I just always had a real interest in history and the intersection of history and literature. I felt like, I'm going to have these 4 years in college. When's the next time I'd be able to just, read and think. And so I figured, just take that on as a study. And I did that. I'd also I'd studied Japanese language in high school out in San Francisco, and I studied Japanese as well and in college. And so I did my senior thesis actually on U.S. labor policy in occupied Japan. It sounds like a real niche, and it is, but I think it's actually one of the more interesting and, you know, sort of unexplored periods of American history, which is after World War II, the U.S. occupied Japan. Douglas MacArthur was the supreme commander, and it was just sort of it was a lot of focus. People talk about Europe and about the Marshall Plan and all of that, but I was really interested in sort of how U.S. sort of power was manifest in the Pacific. You know, I think growing up in San Francisco, you tend to look west a lot and over the ocean as much as east, and, you know, Asia felt closer than Europe in many ways. And so I was sort of interested in that. So that was sort of my college years.
So, so since you bring it up, I'm curious, I didn't think about that period. I haven't read much about that period in that region. Read a lot about and learned a lot about post-World War II Europe, but not much about Japan. So, and in particular, labor policy was your focus.
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, I was really interested because, you know, I'd studied U.S. history, and labor was a very contentious issue, as it is now. But it was really contentious in the 20s and 30s, and, you know, there were strikes and violence, and you know, and it was really a flashpoint about what it meant to be an American or who was a communist, and all these kind of questions were raised. And after World War II, you know, Japan, obviously Imperial Japan, and was defeated. And the U.S. went in and occupied, and it was a very tense period because the Soviets had stayed out of the war, and they came in at the last minute, and they tried to start occupying parts of Asia, and I mean, obviously the Korean Peninsula. We sort of saw that divided, but you know, here you had America was trying to promote democracy, and the head of it was Douglas MacArthur, who nobody would confuse for being a bleeding heart liberal. But he really pushed for, and there were elements of the occupation that really pushed for a very pro-labor policy as a way to be sort of a bulwark against the nationalism and the militarism that had propelled Japan into the war. And that lasted for a while. And the socialists were very powerful, the Socialist Party in Japan. There was also a Communist Party. Those were different. But and then once the Soviets started detonating atomic bombs, the Cold War sort of ramped up. There was a pushback against labor and against sort of these more, you know, because labor was already associated with you know, socialism and communism as well. And so there was a pushback and a retrenchment on the part of the American occupation that became more conservative and sort of locked Japan into a different, you know, different sort of form of Japanese democracy. And, it sounds like very, you know, as I said, it sounds very niche, but I think it's, if you look at what's happened in, you know, sort of Asia, you know, post-war Asia has done as much to shape American policy, you could argue has done more to shape American policy than post-war Europe in many ways. I mean, we fought, the U.S. U.S. fought two wars, you know, hot wars in Korea and Vietnam, you know, China, the opening of China, Taiwan, you know, still to this day, obviously Korea. I mean, it's a pretty interesting place. I've always thought it was interesting. So,
of the you described some of the struggles between, you know, various factions, and there were certain motifs that seemed to that was being meted out at that time in Japan. Do you see those motifs playing out in domestically today, like what's happening in America
today?
Yeah,
that's a really good question, and I do. I mean, I think there's a question of what is democracy? I mean, who has power? What does it mean? How is power allocated? And I think that if you look at, you know, we obviously live in a very polarized time, and there's a lot of skepticism or just outright hostility among different groups to across that political divide. But I think if you ask both groups, they would say that they're the ones defending democracy, that they're the ones defending American democracy against threats from the other side. And, you know, I think that this question of what does it mean to be, you know, a member of a democracy, you know, who gets the power? Is it, and, you know, this was a real question because they were trying to build Japanese democracy, and they were doing it in a way that was, you know, it was based on an American model. But if you think about the American model. I mean, you know, our country, and this is something I've literally learned and, you know, through my studies, and I just, you know, I've written about it, and it just always strikes me at just how young our country is. I mean, if you consider, you know, if you consider 80 years ago, we're talking what, it's like, you know, 1840 and then 80 years, or sorry, yeah, 1940 rather. And then 80 years before that, you're talking about 1860 and you're back at the Civil War. That's like two generations. And then before that, you're back at the Revolution. So like all this stuff, all this journey we've been on and what it means to be an American, which obviously has changed dramatically, is in a pretty compressed period of time. And so when we see, what I think was interesting is when we try to project what it means to be an American or what American democracy means around the world, like we did in Japan, it is very reflecting on our own sense of what it is. And I think that obviously that those questions remain very much unresolved as we see today. Like, what does it mean to be an American? Who gets to be an American? Who has the power? Who votes?
Yeah. Before we move on, I wanted to tell you about something else that's important. Money. Specifically your money. In all seriousness, I wanted to tell you about my advisor and my friend, George Meza. George runs Meza Wealth Management. And with George, it's not just about money. It's about helping us manage our present and plan for our future. And unlike a lot of other firms out there, George and I actually have a relationship. He knows me, he knows my family, and I know his wonderful family. I also know his firm and the incredible team he's put together, from his chief investment officer to some of the other great people in his office, like Jessica, their head of operations, that are always there to help me and with all aspects of our portfolio. You see, the thing is, I got a lot going on. I guess we all got a lot going on, and I don't have the time to watch our investments all day, every day. And even if I did, I don't have the experience and expertise that George's team collectively has. So we get the entire Meza Wealth Management team, all their expertise and all their integrity. And again, it's based on George knowing me personally, knowing my goals, and even the kind of risk that's appropriate for me to take, which, by the way, could change from one season to the next. And they're on top of all of that. So if you want George Meza and Meza Wealth Management to be on your team, just visit their website, MezaWealth.com. That's M-E-Z-A Wealth.com, www.MezaWealth.com. And that will also be in our show notes, so you can check that. And now, back to our show. You asked a question in the preface to the book that you co-wrote with Dan Rather, What Unites Us. I'd like to ask you that now, since you brought it up. The question simply is, who are we and where are we going?
You know, I think that's a question that is always, we're always going to have to ask. And that the answer is always unknowable and unchangeable. I think who we are, I mean, I think you start by looking back from where we've come, and you know, we've both come a long way and we have a long way to go. And I mean, I always sort of think about, you know, and it's not original, obviously, but you think about our founding documents and how aspirational they were, but how the gulf between what those were and what our reality was at our founding. I mean, we had enslaved people, we had women couldn't vote, we had all sorts of things that, you know, were so different from all men are created equal and all of those questions. And so, you know, it's just sort of, I think, this constant struggle about reconciling that and who we are. I mean, maybe I'm by nature an optimist. I think that some of our divisions are, you know, I think there's a lot of factors that are exacerbating them. I think I sometimes think of ourselves, I think of, I don't know, I mean, how, I think, you know, how much of a sports fan you are, but I think about, you know, you go to a game and you see people that have taken on their teams. I mean, I don't know, go to Yankees, Red Sox, or, you know, Giants, Dodgers, or, you know, whatever, one of these sort of big rivalries. And you see just people have so much basically in common. They might be similar races. They might be similar backgrounds. You know, if they met at a school and they didn't know who they rooted for, they would be fast friends. And they're ready to fight. They're ready to just like, just, and it's because they've sort of associating with something. I think that we have profound differences in how people view this country, but I think there is some sense that we see ourselves on different teams. And when you see yourself on a team, you know, the point of a team is to win. And if you win, that means somebody's lost. And I think that dynamic is sort of where we are now. But I also think one of the things that I've really learned by working with Dan and rather and other people who have, you know, lived a long life, is that there have been a lot of periods like this in American history. That, and sometimes I think we feel like our period is unique in how fraught it is and how uncertain our future is. But that's because we look back and we see those earlier periods have been resolved. And so I my hope is, and I think my belief is that at some point we will look back at this period, and for all the fraughtness to it, that it will somehow get resolved, and maybe we will be in a better place as a country because, as a result.
Yeah, you know, a lot of those moments were really close calls. You know, you mentioned the Civil War. It was a pretty close call that Abraham Lincoln would have been elected. It, you know, a couple of the, you know, amendments, you know, really close calls that really shaped the next 80 years and the next 80 years. You know, the late 60s, I mean, was another more recent period when, talk about fraught, you know, the death of Dr. King and the death of RFK and, you know, shortly thereafter, Watergate and Vietnam ongoing. There's so much, you know, that it makes me think of the opening to one of my favorite Tennessee Williams plays, Glass Menagerie. In Spain, there was Guernica. Here, there was only shouting and confusion, you know, and it seems like we're really shouting and confused right now. So, okay, so you have me, I have a lot of different questions that are brewing in my mind right now, but I want to learn a little bit more about you because you were in a different sort of a role. You were in a producer role. You were in a supporting role because you helped bring other, you know, ideas to life with others taking the lead, at least on camera or the lead voice in journalism. You made the switch now where you're the voice, it's your voice. When did you decide to make that switch and how has it been for you?
That's a good question again. I mean, I think I've worked, you know, I got my start at CBS News and so television journalism, and it was I came at the very end of the heyday. Like, so I was there at a time when I could see what it once was and then see where it was also going. And obviously its impact of the evening news or the major news networks are just a fraction of what they were at the in the 80s or 90s or, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. But, you know, the nature of television news is that it's inherently collaborative, like, and that it just takes a lot of people to do the job. You know, there's the correspondents who get the most attention and, you know, and sort of the public faces. But there's producers and writers and editors and cinematographers. There's people that are booking travel. There's people that make sure that when you arrive, there's a car waiting for you, or that, you know, you have protection, or, you know, or give you money, you know, to go out into the field. Or, I mean, all this, it's just, they're operations. They're almost like, and, you know, they've shrunk a bit, but they're, it's almost like, you know, you think about an army and but all that it takes to put, you know, a group out into the field. So, you know, I always liked that collaborative environment, and I still do a lot of filmmaking, which is also very collaborative. So there's always been part of me that I just need to be part of a collaborative environment. You know, I started working with Dan and writing with him, you know, first on sort of social media, and then we wrote this book, What Unites Us, and we started the Substack Steady. And, you know, I love it. I loved it. I, you know, he continues to be a dear friend, and, you know, we talk often. But I was sort of like also going through a period of my life with my children growing older, and I'm growing older, my parents. I mean, just, you know, just seeing the world and just feeling like, you know, I don't know. I'm living something that I felt I wanted to see what it was like to share with people. Like, you know, I felt that, you know, a lot of my friends, you know, I just turned 50. It's just a sort of a more of a watershed mark than I thought it would be. And I just felt it was sort of time to, you know, I there was just ideas that came into my head that I would experience with my kids or talking to a friend or reading somewhere or living out here in San Francisco that, you know, or whatever, making science films or all the stuff I'm doing that just felt like, I just wanted an outlet to start sharing that. And so Dan and I talked, and, you know, he's gone on and Steady's gone on and is doing wonderfully. And I'm thrilled to see that, you know, and I've started this, Through the Fog, Substack, which I really love. I mean, it's, my wife jokes, is this, you know, is this a hobby or a job? And well, by the income, it's a hobby, but but you know, it's but I think it's it, you know, I take it seriously because I don't know, it just feels like it's a, an adventure that was the right time for me to start on.
Right. Did you happen to read David Brooks' 2019 book, The Second Mountain?
I did not. I mean, it's on my list. Yeah.
I mean, his latest book is definitely worth a read because it's so, it's such a, it's so apt for the moment that we're in now.
Right.
Societally, How to Know a Person, The Art of Seeing Others Deeply and Being Deeply Seen really had a profound impact on me when I first read it. And now I'm actually reading it with a book club that I'm a part of and we're going through it. But the one, the prior one that he wrote in 20, that came out in 2019 was, I read it at a moment when I was in a very similar position as the transition that you're making now. And it was very clarifying. A lot of times writers that I'm drawn to end up giving me a vocabulary for things that I'm mulling over, considering, grappling with. And he definitely did that and then helped to extend some concepts, extend some principles. So the idea of that book was, a lot of folks climb the first mountain on whatever talent, intelligence, hard work, work ethic, creativity, specific talents and virtues, right? When you're first setting out, oftentimes you're not quite clear on the bigger picture, the raison d'etre, right? You're just kind of going on your steam and thinking that maybe it's the money thing or the title thing or, you know, those... The outer look of success, right? And then by the time we're, you know, I'm a couple of years older than you, just a couple of years older than you. I'll be 53 in the summer. So I was 48, 49 when I was going, like really thinking about this stuff. You know, by the time, if we've lived this long, we've been through something or a lot of things. You know, some folks go through divorce. Some folks have a really terrible illness that they've had to get through, a death of a loved one, a financial collapse, any number of things can happen to us. We find ourselves getting knocked off the mountain one way or the other, but we still have that work ethic. We still have that creativity. We still have all of those virtues. So now we're going to climb that second mountain with a clarity on what is it that's important? What is it? Asking the question of, who am I within the context of my world, whether my world is just my immediate family or my closest community, you know, who am I and what can I offer to this, you know, this world, however you might define that. And with that clarity of an order of values. And it sounds like so if nothing else, I would just, let me just add to the recommendations. Read that book. I think it'll help you think through some things as it did for me. But it sounds like you're already on that path, man. It sounds like you're,
Well, it sounds like a fascinating book. And I read David and I know that, you know, he's also gone on his journeys and, you know, in senses of, I think that there's a sense also that there's a certain momentum that if you're lucky can carry you from sort of adolescence through young adulthood. And then you feel like you're on a track.
Right.
And I think that it's like at some point that track sort of ends, or you sort of, you know, or the momentum that you were on starts to wane and you're like, well, you know, there are some people that made so much money or whatever by that age that they just sort of, they hang it up and they just, you know, play or whatever. But I don't know. You know, I think that, you know, for people that really enjoy the work they're doing and are lucky to have that privilege, you know, it's just sort of like, well, what's next? And so, I mean, I've also felt, I've always been someone, I think I'm naturally restless as a person that I, you know, it's like, if I feel like I can do something and I've sort of done it to some ability, then I'm sort of like, well, what's next? Like, what's my new challenge? And I think that's sort of been, it's, you know, for me, it's like, well, I'm just looking for a challenge. I think that's a way to, for me at least, to feel young and engaged, is to sort of say, well, you know, what's something new? Let's start something new. And for me, this was something new. And, you know, it's just the idea that I'm starting something at this point in my life where I have no idea where it's going to go. you know, that just feels rejuvenating for me too.
Well, if you want to add to that portfolio of something new, if you ever wanted to add a podcast, you know, maybe some extra content for your subscribers, I am an absolute podcast geek, and I would love to talk to you about that.
I've thought about it. I mean, I feel like let's get the writing settled for a little bit, but I love talking to people. I think that we have too little dialogue, and the stuff we have is often internalized, and it's good to get out of the bubble and to sort of talk to different people. And it's also, I mean, I think one thing it's great about podcasts is they're often not short. And I think that, you know, I think there's this sort of general perception that Americans have no attention span. And I don't understand that.
I disagree completely.
I mean, people binge, you know, television, they listen to podcasts, they, you know, sit at a baseball game for 3 hours. I mean, it's like, yeah. I don't think that's true, but I think that perception guides in a very negative way a lot of what's offered to Americans, the sense that we can't handle depth. And I don't know. I don't think it's true at all. And I don't think that the evidence bears it out.
So just to underscore that point, one of my kids is 20. He'll be 21 in July. And you could look that he's right smack in the middle of Gen Z, where they're supposed to have like not even 6 second attention spans, but like 0.6 second attention spans. And the way they go through their phone, it's really affected their brains. And yet you get that he has the best work ethic than just about anybody that I know. He's a welder now, and you get him in a 110 degree factory floor working, and he's had three different bosses. All of them told me a version of the same thing. They love the fact that he's working just as hard at 6 a.m. when he shows up, actually shows up a little earlier than that, as he is at the end of his shift at 3 p.m., 4 p.m., 6 p.m. So that's an attention span. It's its own form of it, but it's an attention span.
Oh, yeah. No, I think that, you know, I think that I don't know, the kids get a bum rap. I really don't.
How old are your girls, by the way?
My girls are, better not mess this up, they're 15 and 11.
Okay. You're in the thick of it, man.
totally in the thick of it. But, you know, again, there are times when they're scrolling through their phones, but there are other times when they're really just focused or, you know, I mean, I'm really lucky. They get along really well with each other. They're each other's best friend.
That's good.
Just,
you
know,
nice.
Just seeing them interact and just seeing, you know, the depth of experiences they have and the friendships they have. And they, you know, they want to go. A younger one, like, you know, she has a bigger sense of freedom recently. She takes the bus back and forth to school with her friends, and they go to the park, and, you know, they're not, I just feel like, you know, there's a lot of a sense that the future is bleak. And I don't know, the more I'm around children and young people, I don't feel that. I have a lot of optimism that the kids are going to figure it out and they're going to be all right.
I was curious about you, how, so you mentioned that your wife is part Hawaiian and the girls obviously are part Hawaiian. Are you mindfully doing things throughout the year, marking times in their life to kind of invest them with a sense of their heritage on your wife's side or on your side? How are you doing that?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think that our my family we're Jewish, and we, you know, culturally especially, and that's been important to me. And my wife's mother is half Native Hawaiian, and she also is part Japanese and part German. And then her father is, you know, Anglo-Saxon. I think that for us, the way that family is very important to us, and our kids have very close relationships with their grandparents. And I think that a lot of the experience of their culture, I think, is we try to facilitate it directly from their grandparents and sharing events or just occasions with their grandparents. I was very close with my grandparents. I learned a lot from them. You know, they lived in Chicago. We would go visit them twice a year if we could. And so I really feel that just, I feel you can learn a lot from being around older people, sort of getting that sense of a continuity of generations. So I think that's been a big part of how we've instilled the culture and the background in our kids.
That's great. I wish that we were more we thought about it more when the kids were younger, but you know how it is. You have one, you have two, we had a third, and you just get caught up in life. And next thing you know, you're 10 years on, 15 years on, and you're like, whoa, how did we get here? But actually, I should say, there have been things that we've done over the years. For example, I grew up Jewish, observant. We went to an Orthodox synagogue, but I became a Christian when I was 29. Mm-hmm. And it was right before, it was about a year before Savannah. It was only about 3 or 4 months before Savannah was born, our first. And then when the boys were born, we decided by that time, I had a fraught relationship with my dad, as you could imagine, after I told him I became a Christian. But one of the things that started to repair some of that relationship was when we decided to have a Brit Milah for the boys. Which I felt didn't, you know, compromise my theological convictions at all, but it honored our heritage in a symbolic ritualistic way. And then over the years, we've incorporated other things like my parents will bring them where it's about to be Purim as we record this. So, you know, my parents brought them to the Purim festival. We have Seder every year, you know, so the kids know. And then there's one thing in the Seder, at least as we go through it, the story, the Haggadah that we read, it's all in the third person, first person plural. It's all in the we. This is what God did for us. So the kids are getting a sense of who we are, you know, who we are as part of this family, as part of a larger people. So there's something very rich in that, especially knowing that this is something my father did, that my grandfather did, that, you know, for many, many generations. And my grandmother, obviously, you know, that there's something very meaningful and rich in that experience. So,
And I think that, you know, that if you look at, I mean, this is what's so interesting to me going to Hawaii, it's sort of a microcosm of, I think, where the country's going, and that it's very multicultural, multi-ethnic, multiracial place. And I think that, you know, more and more, you know, families are going to have to figure out how they balance a variety of traditions, you know, as more traditions, you know, I mean, my parents grew up in a Jewish neighborhood in Chicago. They, you know, they went to public school, but everybody was Jewish because everybody in the neighborhood was Jewish. And then a couple of neighborhoods over, everybody was Polish or Irish or Black. And so, you know, but, you know, if you look at our country today, there's so much more intermarriage. There's so much more, you know, it's just a different world. And I think that, you know, that's part of, I think, what's going to be the challenge is how do you take identities from the past with you, but also aren't imprisoned by them, right? I mean, it's like, you know, I think that a very strong identity can be a source of strength for people, and gives them grounding and connection to their ancestors. But it also, you know, if sort of wielded in the wrong way, it could also be a way of throwing up barriers that I think, as we talked about earlier, you know, can contribute to the polarization of our society and some of the struggles that we face. So I think it's a balance that I think we're pretty early in trying to figure out. And there's never been a country quite like ours that's had to deal with that so explicitly.
Yeah. That's an interesting thought, to have a strong sense of identity without being imprisoned by that. That's an interesting, I don't know exactly, one of the images that comes to mind a couple of days ago, again, as we were recording this, was St. Paddy's Day. And there are so many people who are 1/4, 1/8, 1/16 Irish, but they still proudly celebrate their that part of their heritage. That might be one way to do it. Get alcohol involved, especially when there's green beer, you know.
And there's a thing, I think one of the things that strikes me about the United States is, there's a belief that anybody, I mean, we'll see that challenged a little bit, but in its best sense, I believe that anybody can be an American. And that if you consider that the vast majority of people have emigrated here, not just since 1900, but since 1950, if, you know, most people here can trace their roots to people that came relatively recently. And yet people adopt, you know, colonial history as their history. They adopt, you know, and there's all sorts of problems there around race and all sorts of other questions that, you know, I think we need to have an honest reckoning with. But there is a sense that, you know, it in other places, it's really hard to be, you know, if you're not born in France, then how do you become French or Japanese? But to be an American, it was always something that people could adopt, and then they could claim Independence Day as their own, even though almost nobody ancestors were here around here at the first Independence Day. It's still something that we celebrate and that we sort of recognize and take pride in. And so I think that there's a sense that we can, that our nation is built on adding that identity to ourselves, no matter where we're from, at least in its best sense, that's what it should be. And I think hopefully that can be a model for how we hold on, you know, how we adopt something new, but still hold on to what we come from. So you have people like, oh, I'm a proud Italian American, but I'm celebrating, you know, American holidays as well. So it's, yeah. I think that that's, I don't know. It's, you know, it's, as I say, you know, when we talked about it earlier, it's still a work in progress and it's unclear where all of this goes, but you know, that's sort of the basic foundation is that anybody can adopt this country as their own or should be able to.
Yeah.
No matter where they're from.
You know, so you brought up something before that I do want to push back on a little bit, and your mm-hmm. work, I think if we dive into some of your recent pieces that you've written on the Substack, mm-hmm. by the way, I'll include this in the show notes, but definitely highly recommend Through the Fog. Every few days, there's another piece that really gets me thinking about stuff. So one in particular, I've been thinking about just the five freedoms that are memorialized mm-hmm. in the First Amendment mm-hmm. and how in very concrete ways, several, if not all of those five freedoms have been threatened. You know, mm-hmm. I was just freedom of assembly, how Trump, you know, in the final months, I think in June of 2020, cleared Lafayette Square. Mm-hmm. And now there's mm-hmm. reports that he was talking to, you know, his senior officials and saying, well, why can't we shoot these people? Mm-hmm. You know, so the freedom of assembly, freedom of speech from the very get-go, the enemy of the people. Mm-hmm. You know, he now, what's his name? Stephen Miller is talking about, well, let's arrest him and let the law catch up with what we're doing. And he's mm-hmm. talking about anybody from immigrants to journalists that they don't like.
Yep.
You know, freedom of speech, obviously, is under attack in very concrete ways. Now, you had a piece where you were talking about it. This is really an election of ideals. So I was hoping that you could share with listeners the way you see the stakes in this upcoming election. So to contextualize the comparison of the two leading candidates around fundamental values, that's ultimately what we're talking about. So I was hoping you could share a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. You know, I think the question is where we is like, what is this country about? Who is it for? What do we value? And I think that, you know, in most previous elections, and I, you know, remember, they were ostensibly about policy. You know, it was about people looking at what our priorities are, and you know, what should we do about taxes or immigration and those kind of things. And you know, and these are difficult questions. They're questions that people of good faith can disagree on. You know, it's part of what makes a democracy robust should be a vigorous debate, you know, and I think that there should be a belief, no matter who you are, that no one side or no one cohort has a monopoly on wisdom. Like I think the premise of democracy is that we all can learn from each other. And that, you know, if there's a place where debate can be healthy and nonviolent and can lead to policy, then that's a strength, not a weakness. That, you know, and I think if you look at over the course of our history, that's borne out, that there have been good ideas have come from many different places and many different kinds of people. Where I think we are now is something fundamentally different. And it's, do we believe in democracy? Do we believe in a system that's going to allow for that open debate? Or do we believe in something that's really more looks like autocracy? Or, you know, or sort of the power of a minority faction to exert its will on the majority, you know, backed up by voting patterns and the Electoral College and the court packing of the courts and all sorts of things that have happened over time, but have hit a moment of real crisis. And it's not just now. And we saw, you know, the closest we came to losing democracy since the Civil War on January 6th, you know, and so I think that this is something fundamentally different, and is really a question of, you know, will we have a situation where people of good faith can continue to disagree and debate, or are we going to have a place where we slide into something that maybe on its, you know, on its on sort of just a very superficial level looks like our democracy? We have bunting and fireworks on 4th of July and all that kind of stuff, but we're fundamental freedoms like the ones you described in the First Amendment and others, and also just a functioning democracy is no longer what it was. And I think those are the stakes as I see it for this election. I know a lot of other people do as well. I do think that a vast majority of this country really believes in a robust and open democracy, but there are all sorts of reasons why that might not carry the day potentially in an election for the presidency and by extension for the Congress in November of this year. And I think that's really a question. I mean, it's a matter of the values of democracy, because, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Well, a listener named Bill wrote to me, mm-hmm. and he had a really constructive criticism. You know, I don't pretend to be, you know, unbiased. I have my biases, mm-hmm. and I think this mm-hmm. is a kind of forum where what was the title of that one? I think that came out today. It's complicated, I think.
Yes.
yeah. It's complicated. So I make no bones about that. I have points of view that I love the nuance. But Bill said, you know, listen, I have family, I have friends that I want to have them listen to the show. I don't know what Bill's political mm-hmm. disposition is. I gather that he's, I'm guessing, I'm probably wrong, but I'm guessing that maybe he's historically been at least right of center. But mm-hmm. his critique was, well, can you ask questions from the point of view of my family and friends who are Trump supporters, for example? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I thought as an experiment, I try to do that just on the first couple of these comparisons. You say this really is an election of ideals. And the first one is democracy versus autocracy. And what mm-hmm. I would say, you know, as the devil's mm-hmm. The devil's advocate, I guess, would be, well, listen, you know, the expansion of the executive branch certainly mm-hmm. was accelerated under Obama. And what we're seeing now, the choice of what, you know, the executive actions to that Biden took in his first days in office to make us less safe and mm-hmm. you know, that allowed for this chaos at the border, mm-hmm. you know, and the expansion of the administrative state is an mm-hmm. autocracy in a way, and removing my participation as a citizen in mm-hmm. In this democratic republic or this representative constitutional republic that we're in. So how would you engage with someone whose concern was that?
I mean, I would have a bit of sympathy in that I do think that we've had an expansion of presidential power that's not ideal. And I would argue that, you know, there was all sorts of executive orders that Trump did as well that were struck down by the courts and everything. But I think we have a real issue in that. I think one of the biggest problems this country is facing, and it's not just it's not unique to the Trump years, it's preceded that, although it's gotten worse, is that we essentially don't have a functional legislature. I mean, we had some good years in Obama. I mean, sorry, good years. Well, to Obama in terms of whatever you think of the policy, there were bills that came out. Some were bipartisan that were passed. If you look at, you know, the first 2 years of the Biden administration before the Democrats lost the House of Representatives, you know, there's a lot of bipartisan bills that were made it out. There still is some bipartisan bills that are making it out. But ideally, and I think the founders believed that we would not have a lot. They were very suspicious of the power of the presidency. And I think that in some ways, my biggest criticism of the modern Republican Party is I think there's a certain cynicism in the way they handle their legislative activities. And I think it's much more pronounced in the House of Representatives than the Senate.
Yeah.
But it's ridiculous that we have a bill in supporting Ukraine, which the overwhelming matters of the people in Congress overwhelmingly support that, and it's not passing. Like, that's not, that's broken. That's not a, and I think that, you know, we shouldn't have executive orders on immigration. But people punt on this. It's a hard issue. As you say, I had a column today about it's complicated, but it is complicated. Nobody's going to be happy. It's a trade-off. It's, you know, there are forces that you that are hard to reconcile. You know, your heart goes out to people struggling with poverty and violence, but you know, you can't have open just everybody in. I mean, so where do you draw the line? I mean, these are hard. Everybody should acknowledge that these aren't easy problems, and that people, again, of good faith can disagree. But the purpose of the Congress, which literally means to come together, is for people of different viewpoints, different constituencies, to try to wrestle with the issue of governance. And I think that obstructionism, I have my own biases as well, but I think if you look at Democratic and Republican administrations, the Democrats in the Senate and the House have shown a much more willingness to negotiate, compromise, and pass legislation than the modern Republican Party. And I don't think it wasn't always that way. There were incredible, you know, legislators in the Republican Party who did amazing things, who worked, you know, closely with across the aisle and had vision I think the biggest issue right now facing this country more than anything is that our Congress represents the worst of our dysfunctions. And as a result, we have problems that aren't getting solved. And so the pressure builds up and it leads to executive action. I guarantee you that Biden would rather have a bipartisan bills to handle these major crises than to issue executive orders. And I think that that's really where people that, you know, you don't have to back down, but you have to recognize that you're not going to get everything you want. And at least either we're going to solve these issues or we're going to just ignore them. And for me, that's the biggest challenge that I would say is facing, in many ways, facing our governance. I think that the Biden in his struggles and Trump, I think they're symptoms of a fundamental dysfunction of our government to handle serious issues on behalf of the American people. And I think it's most of it can be laid at the feet of Congress. And I think that in contrast, you often see at the state level a lot more action happen where people come together and they pass bills and they try things out. And I think that that's, you can see that the gulf in how functional, I think it's gotten a little worse at the state level because it's been infected with some of the national politics and the recriminations and such, and some of the sort of social issues or sort of, you know, I don't know, just messaging bills and things like that. But yeah, I would just say that would be my argument to whoever is saying, why is this is the government so dysfunctional? Why do presidents issue executive orders? I think it's because Congress just doesn't do its job. And I think that in recent years, a majority of the blame can be laid at the feet of obstructionist Republicans who, frankly, are not serving the issues of their own constituents. And I think most people, if you really ask them, no matter what they wanted, where they fall on the political spectrum, would say, I want the government to get things done. I want them to try. I think there's incentives for why people feel like their political power is built on not getting things done. But anyway, it's a long-winded answer, but I think that's really where the problem lies. And I have sympathy for people that look at it and say, this is broken. But I think you got to dig below it and sort of understand why it's broken.
So the natural question is, what do we do to fix it? But I want to ask you a specific question about not necessarily Congress. We just spoke with Danielle Allen, who has a lot of brilliant.
She's wonderful.
Ideas.
Yeah.
And we talked a lot about her ideas of how to expand the House and ranked choice voting.
Yeah.
Remedies that she sees. But again, the trick to get it done with have you met this Congress? but the in terms of remedies, the one that I wanted to ask you about, you were in the news business. You mm-hmm. are in the news business, albeit mm-hmm. in a different role. What's changed about journalism that's made it harder to get good reporting? And then I want to ask about journalists as well as us as consumers. What can those who are committed to doing excellent journalists do to improve things overall? And what can we as consumers do to make sure that we're better informed?
Well, I think that a lot of the problem is systemic in that, and it's technological and it's business. And it's sort of, it's just all conspiring. I mean, you know, people's media habits have changed with the advent of technology. And that has led to a destruction, a decimation really of the local newspaper, which was really, it's really the keystone of the entire journalistic enterprise, because local papers were where original journalism at the local and state level took place. National organization, it would bubble up, big stories would bubble up from there to the national papers, to the news networks. And it's just, you know, it's a lot of it's just technology. I mean, a lot of it's digital technology. You know, there was a, I know it sort of could get a little wonky here, but I always find this fascinating. If you think about in our youth, and I don't know, when you were a child, did your family subscribe to the local paper?
Asbury Park Press, Star Ledger. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And if you think about it, everybody got the paper delivered and they all had a different reason for wanting to read it. Some people were interested in, they wanted to know what the box scores were. Like it's hard to remember. You didn't know necessarily what happened in the game last night, or you didn't know whether the second baseman went 2-for-4 or not until you read the box score. So people had box score. People want to know the weather. People looked at their horoscopes. People looked at their stock quotes.
The movie this times.
Was a, movie times, another thing. Want ads were a big deal, you know. The local, so if you think, and then editorial pages, they're advice columns. And if you think about that, everybody, you know, the weather, you know, if I mentioned that, it was a big deal. But if you think about that now, you get all of those via apps on your phone immediately. Yeah. And so what happened was people would pay for the newspaper. Now, most people weren't necessarily paying because they were going to read the in-depth investigative report on sort of money laundering at the board of supervisor level or something like that. They were, they might glance at it, they would see it, they flip through it. But they were also coming for a lot of other reasons. Slowly, one by one, there was ESPN and there was CNBC, and then there's the Weather Channel and all of that. The reasons for buying newspapers just has disappeared for a lot of people. And that's plummeted. We have, the network news divisions, there's been just so many more channels. So their power is much less. They earn less money. Their audience is less. They have less impact. It's sending people out into the field is expensive. Doing investigative reporting is expensive. So the business model has really collapsed. And at the same time as this new technology, and I don't know what you really do about that. I mean, I think there's it's just, we live in an immediate digital age. A lot of content is free. When people put up a paywall, that people often find something that's not, they don't have to pay for. So it's just eaten the heart out of the endeavor of reporting. It's a really hard career to be in these days. There's certain national organizations that do pretty well, the New York Times and things like that, but the local, press. And then if you think about all these subscriptions, I mean, we have so many subscriptions these days, like different cable channels and everything. So it's like, how many magazines are you going to subscribe to? How many, it's like everything's a subscription. And so, Substacks are another one. So I think that it's harder and harder to sort of have a critical mass around journalism, a business model that supports it. So there's that aspect. I think there's also the rise of partisan journalism. I mean, I think, Fox News in particular has eaten away and caused a lot of sort of mania and skepticism around the news. I think, I think there is some good things about what's emerged. I think that in the olden days, there were the big three networks. Dan Rather was one of the anchors. He was great. But, clearly the news was filtered through fewer people with a similar background. So I think it's great that we have more diverse opinions, more diverse types of reporters. But at the same time, that's been more than offset by a destruction of the business model. And I don't know what you do about that. I mean, I think as consumers of news, people should try to subscribe to places when they think it's important and support them. You think about how much people spend on their daily coffee. Like, that's nothing, it's a lot more than it would cost to subscribe to a keep your local paper going. So I think that's one thing. And I really also hope that, you know, that there's some pressure and on some of the tech companies like Google and Facebook, which take an inordinate amount of the ad revenue off of the news industry. A lot of people with a lot greater wisdom than I have, you know, thought about this, but you know, we really have a crisis here. And it's not clear what to do about it. I mean, I am hopeful that things like Substack and other are emerging and are bringing different voices and shows that there's an eagerness and willingness for people to, you know, podcasting is another one. We've seen, amazing work done on podcasting. So I think there's some hope, but it's nothing replaces the general well-informed sort of thoughtful, you know, portrayal of the news from yesteryear. And if it's sort of crazy, I don't know if you've gone and looked, recently I've looked at some of these old like Time magazines or something. I mean, these were dense articles. They were long articles. They had a lot of words. The type was small. There wasn't a ton of pictures. Like, people really read. That's not where it is today. So
if you ever want a real treat, go back to some of the New York papers of the 1920s and just how they wrote about yesterday's ball game. I mean, it was soaring prose. It was just, some of those articles are just beautiful. To your point, one of the shows that we're launching is a local focused, it's a business show, mm-hmm. But our intent is to really know our audience, mm-hmm. and to know, to engage with our audience in a meaningful way. Because knowing who our audience is, even if it's just geographically, and because it's a subject, the subject is going to be business focused, so we can narrow it down even mm-hmm. more. We then can start to curate who the guests are that we're having on, as well as our sponsors. There's a value to sponsors who folks who have an established business here. I live in Santa Clarita Valley. Mm-hmm. Folks who haven't established a business here, what are their options? They don't really have any, because if it's TV, they have to go into the LA market, and they end up spending a ton of money for ads that are going to, and people in Orange County are going to see, or, you know, LA proper are going to see. So I think to your point, I've been learning the podcasting medium, the nerd that I am about it, but mm-hmm. that's also one of the ways that we can tie a little niche community together.
Corey, I'm glad you mentioned this. Sorry to interrupt you. I mean, I think that hyper-localized journalism and specialty journalism is a real way that we can grow and reinvigorate engagement with journalism with a new generation. In that, like, if I really want to know what's going on in my neighborhood or my city or my local community or the schools, you know, you're just not going to get that at the New York Times or CNN or MSNBC or Fox or anything, you know. And I think people really want to know their community more. I think there's a desire after COVID, especially, that to reengage with our neighbors, reinvest in our communities. And I for all the reasons you mentioned, you know, if we can make a business model and people can say, look, I'm going to support this, you know, and think of it as there's a lot of movement to support local businesses. People will pay extra to go to their local bookstore rather than Amazon because they know that pays for a bookstore to be there or whatever. I think people need to view local journalism the same way, that this is a common good that they're supporting that is going to make their communities better. And that's investing, supporting local journalism is a way to invest in your community. Yeah. I think and I think that if we can instill that, you know, have young people intern or experience what that's like. I mean, it's exciting to be a journalist. It's exciting to chase a story. It's exciting to try to learn something new and hold the powerful accountable. Like, that's pretty cool. And I think if we can put that into a local context, there might be some new green shoots of hope that can emerge.
Yeah, for sure.
So good luck with that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, we might expand it out into other areas of interest, but we're doing it partly as an experiment, partly building on what we've learned from producing these other shows, learning about our audience and what listeners are responding to. And part of it is just about kind of a mission that we feel is emerging. So mm-hmm. I'll keep checking back with you and let you know how it's going.
I have
high hopes for it. If nothing else, I get to talk to some of my neighbors here in this community and have good conversations. Not a lot of downside. So you have just complicated my life, because I thought this was going to be like a, 30, 45 minute conversation. We're an hour and I haven't even talked to you about the science communication lab. So,
I hope that means that. I mean, I'm just long winded.
No, it means to your point that I think in one of your first posts, you said, I love writing, but I love conversation more. You're true to your word, Elliot.
People that know me know I like to talk. So there's a it is what it is.
So a few more questions and then we will start to wrap it up. I was curious about your work with the Science Communication Lab. Were you one of the founders or?
No, it was founded by a professor at UCSF. It used to be called iBiology, Ron Vail. And he had this idea of democratizing science, the early years of YouTube. And he had this idea of, like, if you put science videos out into the world, that people all over the world who might not be at prestigious institutions or in the United States could experience top-notch science and learn from it. So it's really noble endeavor. And then one of his students, Sarah Goodwin, took that and ran with it. And she and I run it now. It's the mission's expanded a little bit to really to make short films and feature length documentaries for students at both high school and college level, and also for the general public. And so it's really exciting for me. I mean, I've always been interested in science. My dad's a scientist, and I always felt that this was a place where there could be a lot more innovation. That a lot of people are scared about science. I think it's experience maybe from their schooling or whatever, but when you really boil down to what it is, which is just curiosity and awe at the wonders of the universe and the world, it's like, it gets pretty exciting. And I think, if people can sort of lose some of their preconceptions about it and just sort of experience the stories and the people that do it, I think we can come a long way to making science actually something that, instead of pushing us apart, which it's been doing in recent years, is actually can be a place of commonality. Because there's something just human about wanting to know what's over the horizon. I mean, that's just been what's driven people all around them, from all cultures, all around the world. And that's ultimately what science is. It's like, what is over that horizon of knowledge? Like, what are we going to find there? And I think if you present it that way to people, then it's in some ways the most human endeavor. It's just wanting to know. And so anyway.
Yeah, no, it's good stuff. I love how you use filmmaking and storytelling and humanizing the scientists themselves. It does make science more accessible and approachable. So I think that's an important endeavor. To your point, thinking about how science was politicized, just mm-hmm. throughout 2020 and subsequent years. So I think it can play an important role in meeting folks where they're at and sharing, important information, science with folks in a cultural language that is digestible. I think it's really good work. So again, I'll definitely put the link to Science Communication Lab there. Yeah. There's, I think there was one that just came out. The she's a PhD, Hawaii.
Oh yes, Yeah, Dr. Kiana Frank. It's really, I really love that one. It's called Decoding Ancestral Knowledge. And it's really about her work looking at using modern scientific techniques to sort of see the wisdom of the stories of the ancestors of from Hawaii. They had stories that they have these amazing fish ponds, which they grew fish for their own to eat. And sort of the health of the fish ponds, they had stories about them based on the flowers that bloomed and things like that. And when she went down and looked at the actual science, that the stories that came out were actually based in real science, and that they were what their ability to observe the natural world. I mean, and most people are come from cultures that were keen observers. That was if you couldn't observe the world in which you lived, it was literally a matter of life and death. So no matter, human cultures carry a need to understand their environments. And I think that these native Hawaiians really understood what a healthy fish pond looked like, and then made stories about it. And then when she went and looked at the actual science, it all adds up. And so it's pretty exciting. I think that's an example too, that, I think there's a belief in the public that some scientists can be haughty or look down at people, but I think the best scientists are really humble because they recognize that there's a lot more that they don't know than they do know. And I think if more of our life and more of our discourse was infused with that, but a certain humility about how certain we are of everything, I think that can be a place for commonality. And I think if we can make science about that, then science itself could be another thing that hopefully brings us together.
So to your point, we had Dr. Francis Collins on a couple months ago.
Oh, yeah.
And he was very candid about some of the things that he would have done differently. And frankly, pre-echoed. What's an echo if it came before your column that was just released today? It's a pre-echo of sorts. But he basically said he wishes that they embraced the notion and the messaging that it's complicated.
Yes.
You know?
There's actually some real people that study science communication are showing, and we're trying to deal with this, is that when scientists, instead of them trying to pretend that everything's obvious and they have all the answers, I think most scientists don't try to do that, but they're trying to say, this is what the science says. Well, you know, people say, well, I'm going to follow the science. Well, you have two scientists who are quote unquote following the science, and they come to different conclusions about something. So what does that even mean? I think that, you know, science, you know, there's certain things that scientists are pretty secure in their beliefs, and there are things that are where there's a lot less uncertainty. And I think one of the real problems with the pandemic is that people experienced the scientific process firsthand, where your early hypotheses were proven wrong, where the more data you got, you're constantly reevaluating. That's a sign of strength. That's what science should do. You know, new data that contradicts what your beliefs are, you change those. But I think that I think the messaging was wrong, a lot of it. And to your point about what, you know, Francis Collins is saying, is that I think that if they said, look, you know, this is what we're wrestling with, this is what we believe, I think it would have maybe minimized some of the skepticism and sort of the polarization that took place.
Yeah, for sure. So I do have a question I like to ask everyone. It's my TPNR question. And that is, what do you think each of us can do to be able to share space with, have better conversations with, and even nurture relationships with people across our differences? So that's people who have different backgrounds and beliefs than we do, who get their news from different sources than we do. How can we do better at talking politics and religion without killing each other? Or is it even possible?
I think it is possible. I think the biggest problem is where we have our conversations, or that we don't have the conversations. So I think it's, if you're sort of yelling at, you know, at a television, you're not talking to someone. They don't hear you. You don't hear them. I just feel like the more you're around or having to interact with people on a face-to-face level, like, you know, who might not agree with you on things, and have to meet them at a human level, I just think that goes a long way. And I think we need to find as a society a way to be less self-isolating. You know, I think social media pushes us into corners. You know, I mean, you know, I sort of believe that there should be a national, you know, work program for people when they graduate. It doesn't have to be military service, but some type of national service that takes people from all these different areas, different backgrounds, and puts them in an environment as young people. And they realize, oh, you know what, you might be a Baptist from Mississippi, and you might be a, you know, Somali immigrant from in Minnesota, and you might be a Republican or a Democrat or gay or whatever the case is, or, you know, different religions or different interests or whatever it is. I just feel like that when people are around other people, I mean, not everybody, but when you're really forced to sit down with people and interact with them, the common humanity overrides the differences. But if you're in a place where you're not, you're allowed to only be around your own people, or that you're only online, which doesn't, you know, where you're there's no burden to yelling or, you know, to raising the heat on someone. There's no pushback. It doesn't hurt you. It just sort of, you throw it out there and you feel good about it, or it riles you up. I just think that's pushing people aside. So I think that it would be really essential for us to try to find ways as a country to bring different people together. I mean, that's something we're actually trying to test with some of our science films. What if we go to a community and bring Republicans and Democrats together, and do a film about humility and science and say, let's talk. Let's, you know, we've sat there together. You know, we might not disagree, but let's at least agree that we're all human and that we can start from there. And I just think we need to find ways to have more in-person communication, more in-person conversation across our divides.
So if you're looking for partners in that, there are a couple of organizations, mm-hmm. just off the top of my head. One is Liz Joyner has become a very, very dear friend, and she runs an organization called The Village Square. And mm-hmm. she's been doing this since 2006, 2007, getting progressive or liberals and conservatives together. You know, she started in Tallahassee, Florida, shut down downtown one time and set up 100 coffee tables and said, one Democrat, one Republican on each side of the coffee table. Here's what we're talking about. Here's two rules to abide by. Ready, go. You know, and she has regular get-togethers to this day.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
It's good stuff. And then the other one you've probably heard of is Braver Angels. I think does incredible work. Monty Guzman. I'm constantly referring to her book, I Never Thought of It That Way, that came out in I think December of 22. But I'm encouraged that there are more and more organizations, you know, Common Ground Committee, there's more that are recognizing the same symptoms in our culture and mm-hmm. are trying to do something very pragmatic about it. So yeah, I think you're onto something. If you ever want any referrals or anything like that, and wanted places and events to shoot, I'm happy to hook you up. And my people are your people, so please don't hesitate to ask.
I appreciate it, Corey.
Absolutely. So a couple more questions.
Sure.
One is, do you have any questions for me?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, first of all, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I guess, are you optimistic about where we're going? I mean, you sort of said, who are we and where are we going? And maybe if I were to turn that back at you, and I've listened to a lot of your shows, so I have a sense, but I'm just curious, you know, it seems like it's a daily occurrence that sometimes, you know, sometimes I'm up, sometimes I'm down, but you know, sort of where we stand right now, are you optimistic about where we are and where we're going?
It's not a fair question to ask of someone who is just re-diagnosed as bipolar. So it really does depend on which extreme I'm in. So in all seriousness, it's hard for me to put a lens of optimistic, pessimistic. I'm not pessimistic. I think it's because I'm so familiar with and feel in my bones the history of my Jewish roots. And what I mean by that is we're still here. We've gone through a lot, you know, going back to the Persians and the Babylonians and the Romans and the, you know, one right after another, different empires, just all they knew, or my grandmother. My grandmother grew up in what's now Chernyostrov, Ukraine, you know, what was then part of the Russian Empire. And she joked, you know, well, you know, the Cossacks hated the Tsar's army. The Tsar's army hated the Bolsheviks. They were all fighting with each other, but they could all at least agree on one thing, and they all hated the Jews, you know?
Right.
And yet here we are. So in that sense, it's kind of a darkly comedic hopefulness, mm-hmm. but, you know, I'm still Jewish after all, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that said, when I look at the election, it's easy to get pessimistic if you're looking so far out as November or even September when some of the voting will be starting, depending on which side you're on. I'm pro-democracy, so I, you know, shamelessly in, you know, favor of a certain outcome. But there's so much that can happen in between mm-hmm. now and then. So much that can happen in between now and then. And I don't want to... When I catch myself getting pessimistic about what if this happens, what if that happens, our democracy, our First Amendment rights, our this, you know, it's easy to get caught up there. And I think having started meditating every day a couple of years ago has really helped me mm-hmm. because I can't control that. You know, mm-hmm. having gone through various life experiences, you learn, you know, there's a lot of things you can't control. There's a lot of things you didn't cause. There's a lot of things you can't cure. There's a lot of things you can't control. But I can control to a certain degree just being able to take a breath in this moment and enjoy a good conversation with a new friend.
I can enjoy a nice walk. I can enjoy, I don't know, connecting with a local, you know, a locally elected official.
Right.
You know, so I'm not really answering your question, I guess, to saying I'm either pessimistic or optimistic. I'm appreciative of what we have now. And I guess a better way to put it is I'm hopeful that one way or the other, it'll be okay.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's, I mean, I think that's a good approach.
Yeah.
It mirrors mine. I think that that's, you know, I think that it's sometimes easy to also to imagine the bad things that can happen and harder to imagine the good things that can happen. I think right now we're trying to figure out like what happens if, you know, pro-democracy and if we lose that, but what happens if democracy is reinvigorated and what happens if we can find a way to start talking to each other more? Like, there's many times that, you know, looking back at our country's history, when darker times have been, you know, followed by a lot of progress and a lot of change. And, So
I think the best thing that we can do is keep things in context, you know, whether it's a larger historical context, or I try to think of things in a theological context.
Right.
And there's a Jewish understanding with what's called tikkun olam. You know, the world is sick. The world is broken. But, you know, there's lots of ways to get caught up in healing the world in various projects, like what you're doing with the Science Communication Lab. You know, you're telling stories and you're engaged in helping to heal the world through science, through helping, bringing people to understand our world better. You know, through your Substack, through the fog, allowing for the fact that it's complicated. So all of these different little things that one person can do, we can get caught up in tikkun olam, in doing little projects, little endeavors that collectively really do heal the world. So with that said, before we go, how can folks follow you, find that great Substack through the fog, more info about Science Communication Lab and all the great work that you're doing?
Well, I mean, just, I'm on Substack. So look up Through the Fog, Elliot Kirshner. And I really use that as a platform to share. You know, if you start following me, you're going to hear about the science and hear some of our films and other things I'm working on and thinking about. And so that's really, I really view that not just as a newsletter, but really as, I think, the best form of social media where you can, engage in sort of deep conversations. And I really love comments. I like getting into the comments and talking to people and fostering dialogue. My hope is as you said, I like writing, but I like conversation more. And it's, I'm more interested in what other people have to say than what I have to say. I already know what I think. So it's always, I sometimes write stuff hoping to hear how other people reflect it. And that way, then I get inspired and start thinking it new. And I think that is, any day that you're on this great earth and you can learn something from somebody else and have discussions like we've had, I don't know. I think that's a vote of optimism for what our species can accomplish, and in the best sense. And so I think as long as we're talking more to each other and less past each other, I think we're going to be okay.
I think we'll be okay. And I'll put the link to this Through the Fog and the Science Communication Lab in the show notes, so you can follow Elliot's work. Elliot, this was a lot of fun, man. I really appreciate getting to know you a little bit better, and I hope it's not the last time we hang out.
Well, likewise. I really enjoy it, Corey. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Thank you for having me.
As always, if you dig what we're doing here, remember to follow, do the rating, but also the reviews, like I've been saying. And tell a friend about Talk Politics and Religion Without Killing Each Other. That way you can have conversations just like these, or I don't know, maybe you can dump gravy on each other's head if you get annoyed with each other at the next Thanksgiving. But we are easy to recommend. It's politicsandreligion.us. www, you spell out the and, politicsandreligion.us. Or you can find me online at Corey S. Nathan, Corey, S as in Sam, Nathan, at Corey S. Nathan. Now go talk some politics and religion. Maybe skip the dumping gravy on each other's head. But do it, do it with gentleness and respect, and have a great week.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the Democracy Group. If you want more podcasts like this, then visit democracygroup.org. There you will find our events, topics, and a newsletter as well. So head on over to democracygroup.org.